Argument on calendar this morning, 71289, NBC Restaurants, 60-minute argument. We have a lead. How is this going to be handled in time, in terms of time?
Good morning, Your Honor. Pursuant to the scheduling order, the petitioners had anticipated that I would utilize 20 minutes for argument and reserve 3 for rebuttal at the end. And then Mr. Ross Kelly will handle 10 minutes of argument on the issues that report to me.
Thank you. Would you begin, please do so.
Thank you, and good morning. May it please the court. My name is Nick Lazorek. I represent petitioners in this matter. We are here today on another case which is going to continue the evolution of the interpretation of the minimum wage amendment here in Nevada. Today's argument, I think, must be considered in light of this court's recent opinions in both Western Cab, decided last March, and Neville, which was decided last month, as well as the legislative failure of AB 175 in the last legislative session in June. The precise issue that the court is interested in today is obviously what statutory precedents will control the assessment of the health plans at issue for determining whether they meet the minimum wage amendment intent, and also what is the procedural jurisdictional issue as to whether these matters should be first brought before the Labor Commissioner for assessment before the direct action is followed in court. From petitioner's viewpoint, we think that your decision in Western Cab last March is somewhat outcome determinative. Obviously, the petitioner respondents had different ideas of what is defined by health plans here in Nevada and how those are interpreted under existing law. We noted in our brief that during the drafting process for the minimum wage amendment in 2006, the legacy statutes, if you will, regarding 289A and B were not referenced nor debated during that process. Instead, the Labor Commissioner was charged and came up with orders and regulations which became codified in the Nevada Administrative Code, Section 608. We note that in Western Cab, 10 months ago, this court concluded that, quote, health insurance, while not explicitly defined in the text of the MWA, is defined in the applicable portions of the Nevada Administrative Code. And also that, quote, with the combined guidance of the minimum wage amendment and NAC 608.1021, any employer of ordinary intelligence should have adequate notice of what health benefits qualify it to pay the lower minimum wage, end quote. In short, I think the court has already tackled the issue and concluded that the interpretation of health benefits or health insurance under the terms of the minimum wage amendment is found within the Nevada Administrative Code. And the inquiry then revolves around whether the plans at issue comply with what the Nevada Administrative Code calls for, which is an assessment of whether the provisions of those plans meet IRS definitions of deductibility. We think the record in this case is quite clear that those elements in the NDC plans, which admittedly are not comprehensive health insurance and never were represented to be such, nevertheless do provide benefits to the employees which qualify for deductibility under the IRS and hence would comply with the Nevada Administrative Code. What happened at the trial court, however, was that the court did not have the benefit or the guidance of Western Cab to determine what employers and others with ordinary intelligence should do, and the court took a different approach as encouraged by the respondents to embrace and adopt, to the exclusion of all other elements, the insurance definitions within 289A and B, which are comprehensive and comprehensive itemizations of what health insurance policies should or could contain, depending on the issuer and the nature of the policy itself. So, for example, while the trial court said you have to embrace every element within 289A, to pass muster of a minimum wage amendment, look at 289A, the direction and the path to compliance is not so clear, because 289A is premised in terms of conditional language such as, for example, if the health insurance policy offers X, then that policy must also perform Y. The argument that every item within 289A or B is required to be part of a health benefits plan that complies with the minimum wage amendment is probably and neither commercially feasible or available nor practical within the constraints of the intent behind the minimum wage amendment, which was, of course, a constitutional amendment to ensure minimum wage and not comprehensive health benefits. I think that the interpretation that the respondents have put on this regarding how comprehensive or how many elements of coverage must be included within a compliant health benefit plan turns the normal and the fair interpretation of the minimum wage amendment somewhat into a nullity. And what I mean by that is in MDC-1, this court took a very pragmatic approach to how to interpret the MWA. This court has said in prior decisions that the Constitution itself is not at war with common sense. It would create a false choice for an employer to need to decide, well, am I going to offer an employee $1 less per hour on minimum wage and offer a health plan that is commercially unavailable or financially unsustainable? So the intent behind giving employers the option to provide health benefits depending on their working circumstances, the situations of their employees, their unique business needs becomes not a choice because no employer with any business sense or no employer, as we say in Western Capital, ordinary intelligence would ever offer a health plan that did not financially and could not commercially make it a viable offering for its business.
Let's say that we accept your position that the district court committed error when it imported 689 and those provisions into this debate, and we should look consistent with Western Cab to NAC 608-102. What is your textual analysis of 608-102-1A? That's my first question, and my second question is there's been some recent cases from at least Judge Navarro in federal district court that does a textual analysis of that regulation, and I'd like your thoughts on that as well.
Well, certainly, and the point on the federal district court decisions which have come down, which are Tyus and one other of Judge Navarro's cases, she accepted Western Cab as precedent. She factored in whether the provisions of those plans at issue before her contained elements that were deductible under the Internal Revenue Service Code. And she concluded that elements of those plans were among those that were deductible and hence passed muster. And she also, I believe, in her decision, did some analysis to the effect that the interpretation or the plain meaning of that language, those items which are deductible, does not mean all items which are deductible. Because again, the argument by the respondents that you must include everything in these plans nullifies their viability. And by way of example, in the IRS code, a person can deduct the cost of installing an elevator in their home if the doctor says you shouldn't be walking upstairs. No health plan would cover the cost of installing an elevator, even though it's deductible. So we look to the language of that, as Judge Navarro did, and said, well, if these items that are in this plan are deductible, although not fully comprehensive to the entire list, which is extensive, that allows them to go through the
But what about the other extreme? And I think your colleagues on the other side of the of the aisle here make the point, well, can an employer get the benefit of the lower wage if that employer simply offers a tooth cleaning once every 5 years kind of policy that would be deductible, but does that qualify as health insurance? What say you to that?
There are two responses to that. One is, these plans that are at issue here, these MBC plans, although the respondents have portrayed them as being Les Miserables, Nevada style, in terms of the paucity of benefits they provide, they actually provided coverage for health services and indemnity payments or reimbursements up to several thousands of dollars in certain cases. At some point, if an employer were trying to get by on the cheap and offer a plan that only covered teeth cleaning, the Division of Insurance would step in and say, this is not insurance, I would presume, because they monitor these types of things. They issue annual guidance as to what...
The insurance, not the labor commissioner?
Well, the labor commissioner, on my second point, is if these were brought before the labor commissioner, he would have the opportunity to weigh in on these issues and say, oh, look, the NAC says this offers tooth cleaning only. I don't think this is in the spirit of the regulation.
Do you believe that 102, the NAC, whatever its number is, 608-102, is clear on its face and requires only that the employer offer insurance that at least some offers one thing, teeth cleaning, for to go with that example, that read literally, that's all that stat, that regulation requires.
As I read the text, which says the plan must cover those categories of health care expenses that are generally deductible by an employee.
Those seems kind of all-encompassing.
Well, so we get into the wordsmithing of it. It doesn't say all, it doesn't say total, and I think if it was all-encompassing, going back to my example, you would have people putting in claims for elevators in their homes. So there needs to be a governor on this type of issue. I think utilizing a common-sense approach, yes, I think an employer could offer a plan that offered $1,000 indemnity for office visits to your physician, and I think that would comply. Teeth cleaning, flu shots as being the only item covered, I think would run afoul of the task of the insurance commissioner or the insurance division, possibly the labor commissioner, in looking at these issues.
Okay.
The problem that I have is with this, and I'm looking for some guidance. How does one, it looks like the court is faced with an issue of trying to interpret the regulation, and in doing so, how do we write an opinion that establishes some middle ground between the two extremes? Are we legislating? If we're going to defer to the regulation, shouldn't we defer to her as she reads and let the labor commissioner reassess that based upon submissions from employers? I just worry, how does one write an opinion that says, well, this extreme's bad and this extreme's bad and wouldn't satisfy? How would we analyze that?
I think you're correct. The legislating should be done by the legislature. So right now we have before us an administrative code section that says those categories of coverage are deductible. I think this court can find readily within the plans at issue and within other plans that are before it in other related cases that there is adequate offerings to bring them in line with the intent behind the administrative code section. I think this court can render a decision that...
Assuming that we conclude that those encompass the various items that are included in 26 U.S.C. Section 213, should those plans be tested in trial as a question of fact for the trier of fact to assess whether or not the plan substantially meets the expectation? I just wonder how one does this as a matter of law without specifically declaring what the guidelines and factors are. Now, maybe we could enunciate
a bunch of factors, but it seems like we step out on a plank and start legislating ourselves once we do that.
We would be in a better position had the regulations been a little clearer. I readily admit we would be in a better position had the Labor Commissioner had a chance to weigh in on these plans. As one of the other arguments we suggested in our brief is that this should be for him at the outset. As any other administrative review goes, he makes a decision or she makes a decision, and then party agreed can take judicial review. That is a logical step to get more input from those who are drafting these statutes. Nevertheless, again, as Judge Navarro did, I think right before us now, this court can make a determination that, yes, the MDC plans do contain provisions which are deductible, multiple provisions per plan, which we
shouldn't we remand that back to the district court to make that assessment if we agree with the approach taken in the two federal cases? I don't know that this court is in the best position to be evaluating the content of the plan.
Well, I think the court and the record speaks to what is in the plans, and the record speaks to what deductibility is, which is a
Well, I'd like to ask you about that question, too, because I'm a little bit concerned about the way the regulation is phrased. I haven't seen this addressed in the two federal court cases. I haven't seen it addressed, really, in the briefing. But when the regulation uses an odd approach by suggesting that it's those categories of expenses that are deductible by the employee, but as we know, under the existing tax law and under the new tax law, there are many medical expenses that are not deductible. Indeed, an employee can't deduct anything depending upon the level or nature of their income. That's troubling to me. You don't assert, do you, that deductibility means actual deductibility?
No, Your Honor, and I believe the answer lies at
26. Because under the new tax law, medical expenses have essentially been eliminated. So if we're tethering this to deductibility, this becomes illusory.
The evolution of federal health care legislation is constantly changing, but I think the answer lies at 26 U.S.C. Section 213, which the detail of deductibility is, quote, for the diagnosis, care, mitigation, treatment, or prevention of disease. So an employee goes to the doctor, goes to the ER, goes to the dentist, incurs medical care, tenders it through the policy. That, by definition, and I think this court can make that finding, by definition, that falls within Section 213, and hence there is no further need for the district court to go back and reweigh the issues.
So why shouldn't that be our definition? And let a trier of fact assess whether the policy fits that definition.
I think that is an absolutely fine definition. And again, I don't believe we need to be remanded back because the answer already lies in the existing record. My time is up, so I appreciate your time, and I'll refer to Mr. Roscoe. Thank you.
Good morning. It's my pleasure to be with you again on these issues. My name is Rick Roskelly. I represent the Amici in this case, the Dryad Restaurant Group, Cedar Enterprises, and Terrible Hearst. The position of the Amici in this matter is that the district court erred in defining the term health benefits as used in the minimum wage amendment by referencing NRS 608-155A sequitur and Chapter 689A and B for two primary reasons. Number one, as already articulated by the petitioner, neither the minimum wage amendment nor Chapter 608 of the NAC reference these statutes. But secondly, and importantly for my argument, if the statutes in question were incorporated into the minimum wage amendment would then be subject to ERISA preemption. It is this latter point that I will address this morning. The Amici are aware that since this briefing of this matter was completed, this court rendered its decision in Western Canberra State Judicial District, which dealt in part with ERISA preemption. In reaching its decision, there are two important parts I'd like to stress. Number one, this court articulated that the minimum wage amendment itself defines the term health benefits and that the NAC defines the term health insurance. Based on these broad definitions, this court held that the minimum wage amendment is not preempted by ERISA for three primary reasons. Number one, this court said minimum wage amendment does not force employers to provide health benefits. Number two, the minimum wage amendment does not alter what an ERISA plan is required to offer. And number three, the minimum wage amendment does not regulate the type of benefits that employers must provide in order to pay the lower tier minimum wage. However, importantly, this court did recognize that, quote, a minimum wage law could be preempted by ERISA if that law refers to or has a connection with employee welfare benefits. It is a position of the amici today that by incorporating Chapter 608's preempted attempts to regulate self-insured plans and the benefits and administrative requirements of individual and group health plans of Chapter 608 or 689A and B into the minimum wage amendment, the minimum wage amendment would then refer to an ERISA plan and have an impermissible connection with employee welfare benefits. Indeed, incorporating these specific benefits and administrative requirements into the definition of health benefits under the minimum wage amendment would result in ERISA preemption of the same, because the minimum wage amendment would then specifically affect employee benefit plans. Because in order to pay the lower tier minimum wage, an employer would be required to, number one, offer an ERISA plan, number two, alter the type and level of benefits of the ERISA plan it does offer, and number three, comply with state-mandated administrative procedures. The fact of this preemption becomes clear when we contrast the incorporating of these statutes done by the district court with the decisions by federal and state courts regarding prevailing wage laws. In the prevailing wage cases dealing with ERISA preemption, all of these cases have certain similarities. Number one, they all found that the statutes in question did not refer to or require an ERISA plan. Number two, they all found that the state statutes did not require the ERISA plan in order for the employer to take advantage of a lower payment for the prevailing wage. Number three, none of these statutes attempted to regulate level or types of benefits. And number four, none of these statutes attempted to regulate plan administration. Let's begin with the most important of these cases. That's the Dillingham case. That's a U.S. Supreme Court case decided in 1997. In that case, the U.S. Supreme Court reviewed a California prevailing wage law that offered a lower prevailing wage for apprentices that participated in state-approved programs. Of importance to us today is the fact that the Supreme Court specifically noted that the California law did not reference or require the use of ERISA plans. In fact, it said that the court said the statute allowed non-ERISA plans to be approved by the state of California. It even went on to say that theoretically a single employer could maintain a non-ERISA apprenticeship plan and pay out of its general assets and satisfy the requirements of the statute. The same was true in the WSB Electric case, the 2007 case decided by the Ninth Circuit. In this case, again, they reviewed a California prevailing wage. This prevailing wage was measured by taking the cash wage actually paid versus the worth of the benefits given to the employer, the prevailing benefits at the time, and their cash value. The court noted that, again, the statute does not reference or require an ERISA plan, and that the prevailing wage was calculated, quote, without regard to whether they consisted of contributions to ERISA plans or not. That is a very important point here. Similarly, in Gallup Business Systems versus City of Los Angeles, a case cited by this court and dealt with this court in the Western Cab case, the Federal District Court of California discussed a living wage ordinance that had two different levels, strikingly similar to the case that we have before us today. One level for if the employer provided health benefits, one level for if the employer did not provide health benefits. In that case, again, the court found it was dispositive that the statute did not dictate the level of health benefits required, the type of benefits, or which type of benefits an employer must choose in order to pay the lower tier of the living wage. Similarly, that was the same finding in the Western Cab case. However, if we were to incorporate into the minimum wage amendment the self-funded and group insurance requirements, the minimum wage amendment would now require the existence of an ERISA plan, because there would be an ERISA plan. You've got funding requirements, you've got requirements for levels of benefits, types of benefits, longevity, notice requirements. All of those are indicia of an ERISA plan. It would also require the maintaining of specified levels of benefits, the adopting of specific administrative processes, all of that in order to qualify for the lower tier minimum wage. In short, the respondents urge this court to incorporate preempted statutes into the definition of health benefits under the minimum wage amendment. One of these is 608-1555. This statute requires employers who provide for health care to provide the same benefits and pay providers in the same manner as the policy of insurance pursuant to Chapter 689A and 689B of the Nevada Revised Statutes. The problem with this incorporation is that it clearly references ERISA health and welfare plans. It requires and entails an ongoing administration of these plans, and it is a blatant attempt to regulate self-funded plans, which is specifically prohibited by ERISA's Deemer Clause, which it says that self-funded plans are not to be deemed insurance for purposes of allowing regulation of state plans under ERISA or under state law. The Attorney General found its companion statute, 608-156 through 158, preempted in 1984. The Attorney General, in opinion number 84-17, specifically found that the statutes in question were regulation of self-funded plans, number one. Number two, that the Nevada statutes in question mandate particular benefit levels for employee benefit plans, and as such, they clearly intrude on federal authority to regulate employee benefit plans exclusively.
Counsel, are those mandated plans, health benefit plans, providing coverage broader than the list of tax deductible deductions that are permitted under 26 U.S.C. 213?
I think that the health benefit...
I mean, I'd like to compare apples and apples.
Right, exactly. And I think going back to the case dealing with prevailing wage, they were specifically very broad for the very reason they don't want to get into ERISA preemption. So I believe that anything that would qualify as a health benefit, and using the Internal Revenue Code is not a bad place to start off with determining what is health benefits, what's deductible by the employer or by the employee as health benefits, is I think a reasonable place to start. But that is in the plans that have been approved, or the statutes that were approved in the prevailing wage area, they were all broad like that. They all said health benefits or apprenticeship programs, but they didn't try to dictate exactly what was to be included in the programs or the levels of benefits. But I guess the short answer to your question is I think they're the health benefits that defined here would be co-extensive as the IRS definition.
So a lot of debate has taken place and a lot has been written and a lot has been argued about whether the court should accept the NAC 608-120 or the group of statutes that have been referenced by real parties in interest, when in fact it appears as though health benefits is basically the same coverage under both, in terms of the benefits that are offered to the employee.
Yes, I would agree.
Okay.
Is my time is up?
Your time is up.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice and Justices, may it please the court, good morning. My name is Bradley Schrager, appearing for the Real Parties in Interest. A number of sort of new points have come up that I will get to in response to what petitioners and amici have raised here. But I also want to make some very simple points, because I know everyone says this when they get up. This is actually a pretty simple case. It throws up a lot of static, and there are a lot of issues you can chase and go down rabbit holes. It's a pretty simple case in its basic questions. The minimum wage amendment to the Nevada Constitution says you have to offer health benefits if you're going to pay the lower tier rate. It further says that those benefits have to be health insurance. Health insurance has to mean something there. It has to have particular characteristics. So we're here today to discuss what health insurance is and what it means under Nevada law. Our answer is pretty simple. In the district court,
we use 681A030. I mean, we're looking for guidance here, and to me, that statute at least offers a definition of health insurance, so we're not all adrift arguing with one another.
It does.
Are you familiar with that statute?
Sure. It does and it doesn't. It's sort of a generalized feeling about, or a declaration legislatively about the kinds of things health insurance does. It doesn't mean that you can't use it. It just means that when you're looking at the minimum wage amendment, in which these employers were mandated to offer health insurance, and they had a group that they had to offer health insurance to, thereby implicating group health insurance to those individuals, the specific, in this instance, of 689B, further informs 681A030, which is a more generalized sort of, this is what health insurance does. It's supposed to, I think it has sort of language about alleviating human suffering, right? Which is true and is admirable as a policy and as a sort of guiding and it should do that. But that doesn't mean that gets us away from the specific requirements of 689A, 689B, and portions of 608. So I don't think you can't use it. I just think you can't stop it, if that's fair. So our answer to what health insurance is and ought to be under Nevada law is
I said there was some... Mr. Schrager, I'm sorry for interrupting you, but it's germane to the point you just addressed with Justice Pickering. Do you agree with amicus counsel, Mr. Roskelly, that health benefits provided under the NAC are essentially defined the same as health benefits provided under 689?
No, I don't agree with that.
What are the differences? What would be one of the major differences, other than the issue about ERISA preemption and the concerns raised by counsel? I'm talking about coverage, description of coverages.
Between the regulation and the set of statutes?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, clearly 689B, which is what I'm going to focus on here, because we're talking about group health insurance, mm-hmm. if I can for a moment, has particular... coverage requirements that must be included in group health insurance for it to be lawful group health insurance. And the Nevada legislature has said these are crucially important for it to function as health insurance. They are things like hospice care and drug and alcohol treatments, autism disorders, coverage for metabolic disease like diabetes, certain vaccines, home health care. The list goes on. Those are specifics. Now,
Does it cover elevators that Mr. Wozniak is concerned about?
Does what cover elevators?
The 689B health benefits.
It does not require it. No, it does not. It does not. The difference being, NAC 608-102 doesn't require any of these specifics. Legislature said those are crucial portions of group health insurance that must be included if you're going to have group health insurance, which is what must be offered under the amendment. Also, all 608-102-1A, the Labor Commissioner's regulation does, well, we'll get to what it does. It either does everything or it does nothing or something in between, which was part of your question earlier to counsel. But no, they aren't the same in that none of the things that are required under the statutes are required under 608-102A. The most that could be said was that the things you would pay for under plans that are valid under 689B would in fact be deductible under at least some earlier version of the IRS code. Right? That's the only intersection I see between these. Now, the district court in this case agreed with us after a voluminous briefing, expert testimony, multiple hearings, that 689A, 689B, and portions of NRS 608 have dozens of statutory sections laying out in express and intricate detail the requirements of group and or employer-provided health insurance. That's what health insurance means. That's why I say this is simple, because in some ways, the syllogism stands uncontested and uncontestable. They have to provide health insurance. They have a group they have to provide it to. The Nevada legislature has said what group health insurance must entail. And in some ways, that's the end of the inquiry. 69A and B, the legislature set out certain minimum requirements for health insurance, period. And it's not surprising that it would do that. Health insurance is among the most critical and highly regulated aspects of our lives. And it touches everyone's lives. Right? It's, in some ways, a matter of life and death every single day in this country. It is crucially important. But insurance is supposed to do something specific. It is supposed to shift risk, right? Health insurance does that. Insurance in our society generally shifts risk. You pay your premiums, and in return, the insurer takes on the risk of a specific event occurring that then they will cover. And we'll get later on into what coverage actually means, because under 608.102, right, you have the Labor Commissioner's regulation, the thing, the plan, whatever it is, has to cover things. You can't just sort of throw a few dollars at an event that costs many, many times. That's to cover something. But we'll get to that in a moment. So, I mean,
the briefing in this case and the district court's decision predated our opinion in Western Cab. And I understand your argument, but I'm concerned about the fact that Western Cab says, and I quote, ERISA does not preempt the MWA because the MWA does not affect the types of benefits an employer must provide or force employers to provide benefits at all. The opinion goes on, and I won't read it to you. I'm sure you've read it. To say that what gives content to health insurance for purposes of the MWA is this regulation and 608.120. Consistent with that, it seems to me we have to start with that regulation. And I think that that Western Cab provides a real roadblock for your argument.
It does and it doesn't. I mean, in some ways, this court is always captive to the order in which cases come before.
But that's one of the problems with this writ review, because whoever gets here first may have...
Right. And, I mean, my answer to that is, this court will always attempt to answer the questions before it, on the facts before it and the law with it, though the heavens fall. Right? So if there are intricacies and difficulties with Western Cab, we'll confront them. One of the ways we can do that at the moment is to say that the question of what is health insurance, not before you in Western Cab. You didn't have 100 pages of briefing. You didn't have 6 volumes of lower court record. And in some sense, the indication of the regulation as the standard for health insurance under the minimum wage amendment in Western Cab is essentially dicta.
Well, no, because they rejected the ERISA preemption argument on the basis that this regulation didn't mandate particular types of coverages.
Right.
It's a problem. I mean, if you were on this side of the bench as opposed to there, what would you say about Western Cab in writing an opinion that credits your position that you're articulating now?
In the ERISA context specifically?
In the Western Cab context, expansively.
Well, let's sort of move out from the ERISA context first, which is what you said about the regulation in Western Cab not mandating particular coverage is still true, even if you use the statutes as a standard. The minimum wage amendment doesn't make anybody do anything other than pay a particular wage. They have no obligation to involve themselves in health insurance plans whatsoever. Basically pay the extra dollar, right? And it was sort of elided in Amici Council's presentation, but that's a key point. In that that's not entirely a get out of a risk free card, but it's pretty close. If you can comply with a particular measure, whether it's a constitutional provision, whether it's a statute, whether it's a regulation, by not involving yourself in a risk plan at all, ERISA cannot preempt. States still have the right under their police powers to regulate wages and to regulate health insurance. What they cannot do is mandate particular coverage qualities in an ERISA plan, which these are not. Right? I mean, one of the things that came up in argument was that, well, back in the 80s, the Attorney General said that 608-1555 through or at SEEK are preempted under ERISA as they apply to self-funded plans. Doesn't matter, these aren't self-funded plans. Right? These employers went out and either purchased or arranged for these plans. So we're sort of out from under the ERISA umbrella, no matter which way you go. Western Cab, though there may be some intricacies in working out Western Cab with an opinion along the lines we would have you write, the result's still the same. Western Cab still comes out the same. Right? There is no ERISA preemption. And the fact that you alluded to, in your opinion, in Western Cab, 608-NAC-608-102, as the standard for healthcare, was, as I say, essentially a preconception of a question that, that was not before you at the time. And if I'm here to do anything, it's to disabuse you of that particular preconception.
But the problem, you have the opposite problem from your colleagues on the other side of the aisle, because you're both grappling with this regulation. If we credit your position, your reading of it, that it is all-encompassing and the insurance to qualify must cover everything deductible under the IRC, that then means, effectively, economically, that this is completely unavailable because you will never get a minimum wage at 10%. You never get insurance affordable at 10% of the lower tier minimum wage being paid the employee that offers that kind of comprehensive.
When the employer would have to pick up the overage.
Yes, it's economically impossible.
Yeah, well, let me say this about our supposed position regarding any versus all. And that's really the heart of the problematic interpretation of NAC 608-102. I mean, as you know, under the IRS code, section 213, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of categories of expenses that can be deducted, or at least up until recently could be deducted. They involve, you know, everything from a flashing phone because you're hard of hearing to an elevator to, I think you can write off, what are they called, service dogs, things of that nature. It's an incredibly wide range. And in fact, if anyone has experience with a health savings account, basically anything you can pay for with your health savings account or card you get is deductible because it's pre-tax dollars. You can walk into CVS and buy antihistamines for your cold, and they are deductible. So the plan allegedly would have to cover all these possible things. And petitioners are shocked by the suggestion that you have to cover all these things. In truth, and I think this comes out in our briefing, we're not crazy people. We're sort of having them on when we say that, right? It's a bit of a tongue-in-cheek, because to us it also points up the absurdity of the other extreme, which is, okay, so it can't be all things. That's literally insane. So apparently the opposite position is that it can be anything, whether it's the teeth cleaning or the relatively slight skinny coverage that's involved in the actual plans here before you. And they actually come out and say it. Anything. That's in their brief. And I sat across from their experts. And I said, could it be a broken toe plan? Yes, broken toe.
Well, but your position is equally all or nothing textually on this regulation. And Western Cab says we have to look at this regulation and apply it in assessing health insurance for the different tier.
I
repeat Justice Hardesty's question to the opponent. How would you write this and give content or meaning that's sensible? And should we just send this on a primary jurisdiction basis to the Labor Commissioner to figure out his regulation?
Actually, I respectfully disagree with about everything you just said.
Okay. I thought you might.
Yes. The reason why we transpose or we hold up this any versus all is to point out that the regulation itself is not workable. Right? It points out not just the interpretive problem with the regulation, but frankly, the interpretive impossibility, because you can't write that opinion card. Right? I mean, we make it's a bit of a joke in our briefing to say, so what's enough? Is it a powertrain warranty? It's going to cover the brain, the heart, the lungs. That's enough. How could a court make that determination of what's enough? Right? The problem is that the regulation itself is what causes this interpretive problem. Only a sort of bright-line test offered by the statutes, which say what group health insurance is, can avoid that particular eventuality. I mean, in the any versus all, you are caught between, let's face it, something that's commercially ridiculous and probably impossible. The idea that you could cover all the things we're talking about in any economically feasible way. Conceded. But on the other side, you are confronted by what is, I'll just call it inhumane. Within the context of the minimum wage amendment, retaining or cutting your wage bill as an employer by 12%, it's retaining that money that would have gone to the lowest paid workers in the state, retaining that because you offered a teeth cleaning plan. Right? So caught between those, I think the problem isn't how you interpret the regulation. I think the problem is the regulation. So let's talk about sort of, the question is, why wouldn't you simply adopt NAC 608-102 for purposes of interpreting the minimum wage amendment? Frankly, flip the question around. The question is, why would you? What are the affirmative reasons to adopt this particular Labor Commissioner regulation as an interpretation of the Constitution? And there aren't many of them, right? I mean, sort of some of it also flows through the jurisdictional question.
Right? As you phrase that, should this have gone to the Labor Commissioner first to get his take on what it says?
No. And the reason for that, they make this argument forcefully, but let's be pretty clear on this in a couple ways. Number one, I think that the objection about jurisdiction or forum is overcome in the first instance by a notion of constitutional supremacy and this court's role in the interpretation of the Constitution. That is, in fact, your highest purpose is to determine the rights, prohibitions, and standards under the Nevada Constitution. This court says what the Nevada Constitution means. Nobody else. That buck stops right here. It doesn't always start here. I'm not saying that there aren't agencies or individuals who are charged with acting in conformance.
Well, sometimes doesn't the Constitution or the acts of our legislature just set the wide outer limits of what's to be done and leaves the details to the lesser?
Yeah. Yes, but in this case, you know, last month you decided not, in which you found an implied private right of action by virtue of the application of certain tests regarding wages, right? That could go to the district court. Didn't say that in those statutes, but you found it. Here you don't need to find it. It's in black and white in the Nevada Constitution, which says, and this is 16B, an employee claiming violation of this section may bring an action against his or her employer in the courts of this state to enforce this section. So there's only one inquiry then. It isn't who could do this best or who would think hard about this. The only inquiry is, have plaintiffs claimed a violation of the Constitution? And if they have, that's the end of the inquiry. Now, petitioners try to say, well, there's only a couple of real questions under the amendment that anybody could take right to court, the 10% issue, and I can't remember what the other one is. That's not true at all. This is a complex amendment with lots of possible causes of action. An employer could violate the tip credit ban. The employer could claim that you've waived minimum wages under your collective bargaining agreement. The employer could fire you for activity in support of your rights under this amendment. The employer could claim that you don't deserve the protections because of the 18-year-old summer job trainee portion of the amendment. All of those you could bring to court to sue. And that list certainly includes, you had to give me health insurance and you didn't do it. Now, it's called a private right of action because it's a right. The plaintiffs have the right, the fundamental right, under the organic law of this state, to bring this in court to have these questions answered here.
Except that the Nevada constitutional provision, section 16B that you just read, well, it's very broad. It says they may bring the action and shall be entitled to all remedies available under the law or in equity, etc. And I wonder whether trying to treat this harmoniously, saying that there's a primary jurisdiction issue here in fleshing out this opaque regulation, is, I'm not convinced that it's inconsistent with 16B of the constitutional section, because the law requires some content to this regulation.
Well, I'd be interested in sort of hearing more about the inconsistency, because the May Bridge report seems to indicate that option is the claimants, the employees. I could bring the court. I could have brought this case before the Labor Commissioner sees what happens. Didn't. Chose to bring it here by virtue of the rights afforded my clients by the Nevada Constitution. Same thing with the remedies. The remedies we're seeking are not administrative remedies. They are legal remedies afforded by courts. So I don't really see that there's a way to shunt this into some sort of administrative process, and not somehow be in derogation of my client's rights under the Constitution to be in court to have these questions answered. Now, let's also talk about why would you adopt the Labor Commissioner standard, or why wouldn't you? Either way. I mean, what are the affirmative reasons for doing so? Now, it seems to me there's two ways to get there. Either by some mechanism of deference, you give deference to the agency or to the Labor Commissioner, or you find it to be a persuasive standard, something you would adopt on your own, by your own rights. Let's start with the first. Now, normally we accord deference to agencies on the basis of their enforcement. Their experience with the issues involved. They have either people who are appointed or they hire people with particular technical expertise. Right? That's the reason why agencies get particular deference. For the life of me, it is not obvious on its face to me what expertise the Labor Commissioner has in setting health insurance standards. That doesn't jive with me. I don't see that at all. But you don't really have to take my word for it. You can take the Labor Commissioner's word for it. Because I think one of the most interesting and important documents in this case and in the record was in our appendix. At Real Parties Appendix 2 and 3. Now, we sent public records requests to the Labor Commissioner saying, okay, well, tell us how you handle these cases. Give us some documents that deal with opinions on qualified health insurance plans. Had no records. Right, well, tell us, hey, do you have examples of insurance plans that you've said qualify? Don't have any records. Right, well, what's your process? They gave us this. It's an incredibly telling document. It's entitled, What is Qualified Health Insurance for Nevada's Two-Tier Minimum Wage System? You would think this would then give some guidance beyond the regulation as to what qualified health insurance is. And in part, it says the question of whether an employer-sponsored health plan is qualified for purposes of paying the reduced minimum wage remains unanswered. Labor Commissioner doesn't say it's answered in full by my regulation. It says it remains unanswered. It's up in the air. Because many insurance brokers began marketing mini-med or discount health plans claiming they met the definition of qualified health plans. But that may not be the case. Here's the kicker of the whole thing. The Labor Commissioner says that it must be determined whether a plan is an actual health insurance plan. The Office of the Labor Commissioner relies on the Nevada Division of Insurance to make that determination. The Labor Commissioner herself, I get the him and her, it was him who promulgated the regulations, but it's Ms. Chambers now. Labor Commissioner herself is saying, in essence, don't ask me about health insurance plans. We don't know anything about it. Go to the insurance commissioner. There's no record that the insurance commissioner has ever weighed in on these things. So the Labor Commissioner is disclaiming the expertise that would, I guess, be the fundament of deference to the Labor Commissioner's standard. Doesn't seem to me that there's much residual deference left. Maybe there is somewhere else. And petitioners come up with this notion of contemporaneous construction. I don't entirely follow it. It seems to be, and it's really the genesis of the regulation itself, isn't in some deep thought about what should be the standard of health insurance specific to this particular problem of the minimum wage amendment.
Doesn't it kind of look like, from that history, that they were trying to dodge any ERISA problems by crafting the regulation pretty generically? Because they did consider, in one version of this regulation, the test that you persuaded Judge Williams to adopt, and then they went with the more generalized one.
And so your question is, was it and it's to stay out of an ERISA problem.
Right.
I mean, it would still be my position that the structure of the minimum wage mandate itself gets you out of an ERISA problem, once again, because you don't have to do it.
I understand that.
I mean, in essence, if the ERISA argument is correct, then the entirety of 689A and B are invalid, right? I mean, because they're obviously trying to regulate the content on insurance. So the minimum wage amendment isn't the one regulating what needs to be in a group health insurance plan. It's the employer's option to adopt or not. It's the statutes. It's the reference to health insurance that leads us there. It's the statutes themselves that do that. No one's making the argument that the entirety of the insurance code is invalid in this state. And I think it wouldn't be invalid. But I will say this about the genesis of the standard, which is it came from the MPT in 2005, the modified business tax, which is actually, that deduction is really good policy in the tax setting. What it says is, okay, your employees, if they went out and paid for the elevator or prescription drugs or, you know, whatever the health benefit expense is, they would get a federal tax deduction. You know what? We're going to encourage you as the employer to pay for those yourselves. And if you do, you're going to get a state deduction against your wage bill, which will reduce your modified business tax exposure. It's actually pretty light. That's great policy. That is terrible policy in the minimum wage amendment, right? It is, you know, this is one of the basic reasons why this regulation is ultra-virus. It is simply not in keeping with what the minimum wage amendment has to be. There's nothing in the MBT about wages other than you cannot hold against someone in the wage context any payments you make for their health benefits plan. But at least in the context of the modified business tax, employers are laying out actual money that they are for the benefit of their employees, and they are getting credited that as against their tax rate. None of that is true in the context of the minimum wage amendment, which has a direct impact on individuals' take-home pay. And the employers aren't laying out any money. These plans don't cost them a thing. So there's absolutely no correlation between what is really good policy for tax and what is really bad policy and a bad interpretation of the American Constitution in the wage amendment. And look, let's...
we're going to run out of time here, but I'd like to get your thoughts on the Tyus and Hanks orders by Judge Navarro and why you disagree, I assume, with her analysis.
Sure. Well, it can be boiled down really simply, which is in the any versus all camp, she's come down on the any camp. Right? She took the most literal possible reading of those categories that are generally deducted. Said, well, the ones that are in there are generally deductible, and that there are no substantive requirements to what health insurance has. That's the root of our disagreement. But of course, what she's doing when she makes that ruling is trying to predict what you will do. Right. So there's an instability there, and clearly a disagreement.
Well, she's reading Western Cab as having decided this.
Right, which I... Which, as I've already stated, I think is an inaccurate view. It's important to have before you all the things you now have before you so you can consider this question clearly. And I don't think Western Cab is in any way, the result is the same in Western Cab. On every question asked, the result is the same, even if, obviously, there's some intricacies that would have to change because of reliance on the statutes as opposed to the regulations. Thank you.
Thank you. Council, we'll give you a full 3 minutes.
Thank you. No, I can be brief. I do believe the question is not Judge Navarro's actions being her estimate of what you may do, but what you have done in Western Cab. And my reference to AB 175 is another example. The legislature tried to pass a bill which codified the arguments that are being made here today in terms of defining what health benefits are under the minimum wage amendment. The governor vetoed that bill because he found Western Cab trumped the legislative decision. The
What's your citation for that?
The governor issued a letter on his veto, which I believe is public record. It's not in this record, but he explicitly said the legislature is doing an in-run essentially around Western Cap. And the query from that case, of course, would be the legislature felt it necessary to pass a bill to codify and define what is health benefits, as we're arguing here. The outcome of this case is not as direct as real parties may argue, because the legislature obviously sees a gap. The goal in this case, obviously, is to give meaning to constitutional provision, which this court has already found to be not void for vagueness, fully enforceable, and the meaning of offering a health benefit plan in lieu for a dollar an hour reduction in minimum wage becomes the false choice I reference if you adopt the 689B theory, if you adopt the all of NAC theory. No employer would ever do it. Therefore, the offer becomes a nullity. And we look for ways to avoid that. The way that it has been avoided through Judge Navarro's actions, through our argument here, is that you allow employers to take offer policies, limited benefit policies, mini policies, whatever you wish to call them, offer them, and then give employees the choice, making it financially affordable for them to do that, and employees the opportunity to take the benefit as they see it. These plans that are an issue before you have substantive financial, economic, and health coverage benefits. No one's disputing that. The question is, they don't offer everything. And again, we don't think the minimum wage amendment requires that. And with that, I thank you. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Sir, if I may. I mean, the district court threw a fair amount of shade at the quality of these health plans.
I'm sorry, did the district court?
Didn't the district court find these health plans were not really health plans at all?
Well,
supplemental, or they didn't offer the benefits?
Court found they did not pass into the realm of 689A and B. They did not comply with those particulars. Counsel engaged in a lot of colloquy as to the elements of these plans, whether they were fair or not. I'm not sure that the district court's order actually said these are not health insurance.
Well, the district court's order described, at least in 1 year, I can't remember which years, I mean, we talked about a number of years, as not even, the health plan itself not even calling itself a health plan, calling it a supplemental insurance to real insurance. So
the disclaimers on those plans are clear and on their face. And again, no one from the petitioner side has ever said these are full-on health insurance plans and they're great in all particulars. They are limited, they are capped, they are stingy, if you will, in certain benefits. They still need some of those NAC tests.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We thank counsel for arguments presented this day. You raise questions, you shed light on our continuing search for what is insurance in the state of Nevada in this context. With that, this matter stands.